The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for Halloween, October 31st, 2019.
Wow. You really reached for it on that one. Nice.
You're like
leaned
the
into it.
People change their Twitter bios Halloween. With like these weird Halloween.
Halloween edition. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. I don't really like Halloween at all. I have no interest in it. But
it's raining here, which is not good for trick-or-treaters.
That's Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine and Yale University Law School. Hello, Emily from New Haven.
Hello.
And then next to me, it's Throwback Thursday because it's super sweaty and John and I are in a studio and it's unbelievably hot, even though it's the end of October. John Dickerson of CBS's 60 Minutes. Hello, John Dickerson.
Hello, David. It's great to be in this sweat lodge with you.
Oh, God. It's terrible. On
you guys look cute, even Gabfest. If you are miserable.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, that's nice.
Oh, that's nice. On today's Gabfest, we will talk about
so easily plied
impeachment.
With a compliment.
We will talk about impeachment. We're going to talk about the House voting on the procedural rules for the ongoing impeachment investigation, the voting that's happening as we tape. Then Twitter is banning all political ads, all campaign ads, all issue ads. Is that the right thing to do or is it superficial? Then the appalling revenge porn / workplace sexual misbehavior incident episode that brought down Democratic Congresswoman Katie Hill. Plus, we will have cocktail chatter. As we're taping, the House of Representatives has just finished a procedural vote on its ongoing impeachment investigation, a vote that will set the rules, the procedures for the investigation as it continues in the House. And indeed, a Democratic-controlled House has, by a vote of 232 to 196, voted to approve these procedures. Every Democrat but two voted in favor, two voted nay, and I think one abstained. Every Republican but three voted against it, three abstained. So it was a very partisan division. John, should we be surprised that the parties held and that Republicans didn't break ranks at all?
No, I don't think we should be surprised, but we should note that 31 Democrats voted to in the equivalent vote in 1998 with Bill Clinton. So 31 Democrats voted to go forward with impeachment proceedings. You know, just a few things we're stating. The Republicans have been calling for a transparent, open process that has a vote. Well, now they've gotten what they called for. They've said they've moved the goalposts, saying that what happened, what preceded it, makes the whole business unfair, and that
fruit of the poison tree.
Right, exactly. There's,
dare I say it,
fruit of the poison tree. And they've also argued that the rules, as the House majority set them up, which is perfectly in keeping with tradition and with the process, that the rules are unfair to Republicans. You know, I think that from my conversations with the Republicans on the Hill, they feel like that they did gain and that they have seen more support for the president in the last few days or so, because the argument that the Democrats were being unfair from a process standpoint was at least causing more vocal response from some portion of the Republican base. Why does that matter? Because lawmakers take that into account. So they're going to stick with this process argument. I guess what I wonder is now, when these pretty compelling voices come forward, these career officials, you know, whether those voices, what they look like now when they're going to be live and in color, I'm not sure I will. I mean, these hearings are going to be a total circus no matter what.
Maybe they should do them in black and white. That would create even more dignity. Mm-hmm. Emily, what, broadly speaking, has the House just approved? What are the outlines of the procedures that they're going to pursue as they move this impeachment investigation from the private circle, this narrow private circle, to a more broader public forum?
There will be public hearings. The president's lawyers will be able to cross-examine witnesses. There will be a procedure where Republican members of the committees can ask to call their own witnesses, and there will be votes on those requests. The Democrats on the committee will still control the outcome because they have more votes in the committees because they're the majority in Congress. But there will be a kind of back and forth and a building of the record, and it will happen out in the open, and it will be challengeable. So in my view, it looks solid. It has fundamental elements of due process that we care about and want to see, and a lot of what the Republicans have been asking for. So I think it will be hard for them to keep complaining about process, though I'm sure, as John pointed out, they will try. I mean, we've already had these completely ludicrous metaphors, like talking about, you know, declaring a mistrial from the Republican majority leader in the, or whatever, the head of the Republicans in the House, Kevin McCarthy, whatever his title is. So, you know, there's already been just such a perversion of these terms getting thrown around that I don't have a lot of faith that we won't continue to hear that rhetoric. But the public's going to be able to see these people talk and assess their credibility.
What was it, John, that made Democrats willing to take this vote? They had been resistant for a while. I think there was a cadre of House members who presumably didn't want to take this vote because they felt it would be damaging, but something changed. What is it that changed?
Well, I think it's been a rolling set of things that have changed. I think the original transcript that we learned this week might have been, and to call it a transcript is to fall into to a mistake at the get-go. So to the summary of the phone call, that I think was the first thing that pushed a lot of those reluctant Democrats into at least being for an inquiry. I think what moved the speaker to have a formal vote, I think, is a kind of combination of things. One is the testimony from people like Bill Taylor, who was the top U.S. person in the embassy in Ukraine, which have been compelling. The way in which what has leaked from the closed-door sessions has established a fact pattern and a storyline that seems to make this look like a serious thing worth investigating. And then I think also probably some pressure on Pelosi that these process arguments are having a little purchase and that they might as well go ahead because that's where they were inevitably going to end up anyway.
Do either of you guys think these process objections will survive, persist, thrive in the new now approved procedures?
I think what we're moving to in terms of the political debate is going to be that Trump did nothing important wrong. That yep. It's going to be about that question because there's just not going to really be anything else. And then you have this question of, like, is this really bad? So I was thinking about analogies to Watergate. In Watergate, you have Nixon implicated in a break-in, which is like a crime, right, into, Democratic headquarters office at the Watergate. And what we have here is the president using the might of his office abroad to try to ask a foreign power to do something scurrilous. So is that equivalent? Is it better? Is it worse?
It's worse.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things, the challenges is for whoever the leader of, I mean, this is a challenge of modernity, but it seems to me a particular challenge for Democrats is to set the problem at the beginning. You know, that's what you have to do in any case, but is to argue, as Emily was just doing, basically saying, here's what we're trying to figure out. Did the president use the government and the whole arm of government, not only his power on a phone call, but also the ambassador to Ukraine, his entire national security apparatus, and then build a second apparatus outside of that for personal political gain? That's one question. The other is, did he warp U.S. policy towards Ukraine for personal political gain? That's another separate category, which is important. Did he irrevocably warp U.S. policymaking by creating what Bill Taylor called the irregular channel, which has its own set of problems, which is not only related to Ukraine, but also all the other ways in which the president used an irregular process for his own personal impulses, which have national security implications? Then you have to figure out whether he has obstructed or shredded or caused to shred important U.S. values in the context of defending himself. So, for example, this week we had Alexander Vindman, who is an Army lieutenant colonel who still carries shrapnel in him from an improvised explosive device from Iraq, who in the defense of the president, some of his allies basically said had dual loyalties. He is literally a poster child for the American idea, which is that no matter where you were born, you can dedicate your life as an immigrant to that idea. Why is he a poster child? Because Ken Burns made a movie about that in which he used as characters in the movie two young children. One of them was Alexander Vindman and the other was his brother. He's literally the poster child of a thing that used to be the central argument of Ronald Reagan's version of America, which is that it is such a powerful ideal that people can come and dedicate their lives in the service of that country based on the strength of that idea. That this week was shredded in the defense of the president. So what other things have been shredded along the way in defense of the president? And then finally, you have the denigration of the Foreign Service, which has been a part of this, which is, in other words, to call people who've dedicated their lives to Foreign Service for the country as never Trumpers or as deep staters or some other thing. Those are kind of the main points. And somebody who articulates that originally and basically tries to pull all those threads you were talking about, Emily, always back to those central questions. And by the way, the answer to those questions can be no. The president's exonerated. Off we go. But just keeping the conversation focused in the modern age of attention shredding seems to me to be basically the biggest task here in the next week.
And that was very well articulated, John. When you put it that way, I'm like, wow, that guy should be impeached. Emily, I actually have a legalistic line of inquiry here, which is so far the president has announced he would not cooperate. They are not many of the people who ought to be testifying have declined to testify. They're not turning over documents. They're not complying with subpoenas. It looks like that's going to continue. I mean, there's still people testifying. The civil service professionals and military officers are coming to testify, but it looks like the president is not going to let any key people who might have something dastardly to say come and actually give sworn testimony, and they're not going to provide any documentation when they don't have to. Is there any compulsion that is now going to work? There's always been this theory that, well, in impeachment, they've got to provide these documents. But are they actually going to have to provide them? Is the Supreme Court going to push in quickly enough to compel that? Would the Supreme Court even compel it?
Oh, I am so happy you asked me this because I'm working on a piece for the Times Magazine as we speak that will go online next week that like tries to delve into these questions. So I actually know the answer, or at least I have ideas. And I have ideas about the history of the answer too. So the Supreme Court has never been asked what to do in a case that pits executive privilege, in other words, a claim by the president that you can't turn over documents, you can't let witnesses testify because they fall within this zone of like presidential confidential communications that's untouchable. That's executive privilege. The Supreme Court has never decided between executive privilege and a congressional subpoena in an impeachment inquiry, in any kind of inquiry. They've just never been asked the question or answered it. So we are in uncharted territory. We actually only have a handful of lower court opinions about this question, and they don't settle the matter because they're not about exactly the same scenario. They're pretty fact-specific. And I think only one of them from the Nixon era is actually about the president, him or herself. So the reason that you are seeing Congress proceed with the career professionals John was talking about is that those are the willing witnesses. And there's nothing that we see in the sort of case law that suggests that willing witnesses who have congressional subpoenas in hand may not testify. Courts have never said that. You asked a different question. An unwilling witness, a top political official like Mike Pompeo or Rudy Giuliani, who of course is not an actual official but is a senior figure in all of this, those people are unwilling witnesses. They're saying, we don't care about your subpoena, Congress, and they have on their side a direct order from the White House counsel that's supposed to apply to everyone not to testify. But what's been totally fascinating is that that direct order from the White House counsel also applies to all these people who have decided to testify. And so even though there's no reason why this congressional subpoena is somehow more legally powerful than a direct order effectively from your boss, these people are coming forward anyway.
How could any court look at that direct order and say, we have directly ordered essentially everyone who works in this administration not to comply with congressional request to talk? And how could the court honor that and say, oh, that's legit. That really is a fair claim of executive privilege. That's absurd.
Yeah, it's very blanket. I mean, you can also see it as an opening gambit, right? It challenges the whole legitimacy of Congress investigating as opposed to a specific act. And I am now channeling Josh Chaffetz, a law professor at Cornell, who I've been talking with this week. So I don't think that that order from the White House counsel, Len Cipollone, is going to hold. But you could still have a lot of fighting in court about the specifics of executive privilege. And it's been interesting. A lot of the witnesses who've appeared have noted along the way that they have not had direct communications with the president. And I think that's deliberate. It's to suggest that this broad executive privilege claim doesn't apply to them. What's happened in the last decade in both the George W. Bush and the Obama administrations was that there was White House balking and stonewalling over congressional subpoenas, not involving the president. The first case has to do with Harriet Myers and Josh Bolten, who were top aides to Bush. The second case, in a much more limited way, was the Obama Justice Department over the Fast and Furious operation, this like anti-gun trafficking operation in the Justice Department that kind of went awry. So they had these long court fights over executive privilege and the power of the subpoena. And basically what Congress learned is that, as Josh put it to me, they can lose by winning. And what I mean by that is that the delay of all the court proceedings and all the discussion among the judges, plus the reluctance of the judges to like decide the questions because this is an interbranch struggle, all of that just plays into the hands of the executive because delay supports the status quo, which is not turning stuff over. And so it just like the political momentum peters out. And so Adam Schiff, who of course is running the impeachment inquiry for the House Democrats, said this week, we're not going to get into a lengthy rope-a-dope game in the courts over this stuff. And that's why the Democrats haven't gone to court to challenge Pompeo and Giuliani and all the folks who are not complying with the subpoenas. But there's this guy, Charles Cooperman, who is a top advisor to John Bolton, Trump's erstwhile national security advisor. And Cooperman has gone to court. And what he has said plaintively and correctly is like, I'm facing these competing demands from the executive and legislative branches. I can't satisfy both of them. What am I supposed to do here? That's a very novel kind of lawsuit. He sued Congress and the executive branch. We don't know what's going to happen with that. But his lawyer, who's a longtime Republican figure in all of this, Chuck Cooper, is also John Bolton's lawyer. And Bolton has said he's not going to show up voluntarily, but kind of invited a subpoena from Congress. And so now we're going to see with those two witnesses what does happen in court. And I would say the kind of nightmare scenario is the Supreme Court reaches out for this case and then shuts down willing witness testimony and reduces the power of the congressional subpoena. And I think that would be bad for this impeachment inquiry, which should proceed with information from government witnesses who are not in. We should have some zone of candor and confidentiality for the presidency by all means, but it should not extend to everybody who works in the executive branch. But also, it would be really bad going forward. It's kind of been useful that we haven't had this question settled. And if the Supreme Court settles in it a bad way, that is going to be unfortunate, highly unfortunate.
So ends Impeachment Law Minute.
Yeah.
Emily Bathlon. That
for
was
me,
awesome.
More like three
impeachment
law
minutes. 7 minutes.
Sorry.
No, that was fantastic. John, actually, I want to jump on that to a kind of a timing question, which is, so what do you think the likely or what are the possible variables about how this proceeds? Yeah. Who wants it to go fast? Yeah. Who wants it to go slow? What could happen?
I don't know. I think it depends on how it plays out. If it is a so let's think through some of the permutations here. If it is like the previous congressional hearings that we've seen, where it's just a chaos madness fest, where both the opposition party is encouraged to just kind of throw up gorilla dust and keep everything confusing and go down side roads and talk about servers in Ukraine and talk about Benghazi and do anything to create a increase the number of threads, whether they're real threads or synthetic ones. And then you have the majority whose job should be to stay focused on points 1 through 5 and continually go back to them and say, we're trying in this set of questions to get at this question 1, 2, or 4, whichever they choose, and not try to build their own reputations by being fancy with their questions or their statements or being outraged or doing all the other things that detract from the central case. depending on how much of that goes on, would depend on how helpful this is or not. I mean, if it goes well and orderly, then it's an orderly case against the president, which maybe doesn't get him impeached in a Republican Senate, but which creates the conditions for the election. If it's a total chaos nightmare for the Democrats, in which they act as a disorganized party, which is almost in the Democratic DNA code, then it becomes something where the president says, and this is in line with his ad campaign that ran during the World Series, yeah, you know, he does some uncouth stuff and he's a little rough around the edges, but, you know, he gets the job done. Now, nevertheless, never mind what the job was in this case, because in this case it was to countervene American foreign policy views in the furtherance of his campaign. Never mind all that. The president will be able to sort of use the confusion or the lack of sufficient evidence to say, look, these guys are just sitting here doing nothing, and at least I'm getting things done. I want to just say three other quick things that are worth keeping in mind. Andrew Johnson, when we think about what people get impeached for, two of the articles against him, one was making three speeches with the intent to attempt to bring into disgrace, ridicule, hatred, contempt, and reproach the Congress of the United States. And then the next one after that was bringing disgrace and ridicule to the presidency by his aforementioned words and actions. So essentially, Andrew Johnson, two of the articles against him were for being a big mouth, which is just an important little historic reminder that when it's a partisan process, the partisans can make the articles of impeachment whatever they want. The problem with that is it's got to survive in the Senate. What might happen in the Senate? I was talking to some senators on the Republican side yesterday who said there is a movement from some of their members to try to vote to immediately dismiss it once there's have a motion to dismiss at the beginning once this gets to the Senate, as it's likely, and they'll assume it will. Robert Byrd, the master of the Senate, self-proclaimed, actually brought up a motion to dismiss with Clinton in 1998. And if you go back and read what the House impeachment managers said at the time about the motion to dismiss, was they basically said this would be a total abrogation of the Senate tradition and history. So we're going to have that repeated one more time here as we go forward.
A hole in my memory. What happened in the Senate in the Bill Clinton impeachment trial?
They David will correct me here, but basically Trent Lott and Ted Kennedy put together a deal. Basically, they all were like, look, we're not going to convict him. But the Republicans had to do they felt like they couldn't just say, oh, thanks, House managers, you did a nice job, but we're going to dismiss this because it doesn't hold up. And we're never going to get the votes. You're never going to get the votes anyway. We have to do basically the minimum to show that we take this seriously and that we care about the work that you did. But that's going to leave no kind of foolishness and loose ends that will let this get out of our control. So basically, Lott and Kennedy came up with this is all from memory, but Lott and Kennedy basically came up with an agreement to limit debate to a certain number of hours. They went and did the debate, and then they had the predictable vote that they were going to they limited
it. Was a majority, but there was a majority for several. No, they there was some evidence.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. There was evidence. Yes. There was evidence, and there was they went through the proper procedure, but they put a time limit on it. And it was a relatively it wasn't super, super long.
Yeah, it was about 10 days, I think. And the vote was a majority vote to convict, but it wasn't a supermajority needed.
Right.
Right. The reason I was thinking about this is that it's important to remember that the impeachment inquiry in the House is not actually the trial. So, right. Like
totally.
Trump is getting a lot of due process for what is essentially like the building of the case for indictment. I mean, it's not a perfect parallel to the criminal process, but there are these two steps in the actual trial part, which is where in a criminal case, most procedural rights attach is not even until you get to the Senate.
And two other things that I was reminded of by someone on the Hill yesterday is, one, during the trial, you cannot have a BlackBerry or an iPhone. It was BlackBerries back in 98, I guess. So they got to sit there and listen, all the jurors. And they're not allowed to talk to each other. And Rehnquist was pretty strict about that. So having the senators focus for that long length of time and not be able to talk is going to be a strain on the body. on its own. But it'll be really interesting to see if it gets to the Senate how that motion to dismiss works, because it was it obviously wasn't successful in 1998, but surely somebody will try to gain a few news cycles out of that and advance
their career.
Oh, for
sure. And then we'll watch Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski and one or two other poor souls be hung up to dry and go through some long anguish, especially Susan Collins, in which in the end she does whatever's politically expedient for her to do.
One thing to watch out for is there's this Kentucky gubernatorial election next week. Whenever that's when the elections are, right? Elections are next week.
Yeah, Tuesday.
And the incumbent governor is incredibly unpopular Republican, Matt Bevin, and he's running against a Democrat who is just focusing on state issues and the unpopularity of the governor. And Bevin is trying to make it about impeachment. Bevin is trying to nationalize the election, make it not about Kentucky, make it about Democrats is trying to impeach the president. And it'll be interesting if Bevin pulls it off. I bet that will embolden Republicans, at least in very red states, that in certain places is going to be a winning issue. I want to end, actually, we haven't really talked about the substance of a lot of the testimony that came out this week, but I want to leave you guys with a question, which is it now possible for Trump or another president to do something like this again, as he did with Ukraine? So
definitely,
we have now signal to foreign governments, we will help you if you do our domestic political bidding. Like that if you do something to help me, we will help you. That Trump has sent that as the strongest possible signal. It is now out there to the world. But on the other hand, you can imagine that if we suddenly see the government of Uzbekistan announcing an inquiry into Elizabeth Warren's investment in Uzbeki mining companies, that people are going to say, "Oh, this is just a dirty trick. This is a false flag," and so it will never be trusted. So, has Trump put himself in a position where he's going to get more of these, or that he can no longer do it? Which is it likely to be?
I think that in the medium to long term, if we don't make a big clear declaration that this is not okay, it's not consistent with our values, as Trump's new Russia ambassador appointee said, I believe, on the Hill, that we are going to get more of this. It will be behind the scenes.
Agree.
It will be corrupt, and it will continue because we are a huge power and people want to deal with us. And, you know, one of the defenses of Trump is going to be that quid pro quos happen all the time in American government. Of course, we're trading things for other things. What we have to keep our eye on the ball is that that does not mean that the president gets to use the might of the entire government to further his own political, personal interests by digging up dirt on his political opponent. Like, that's the part that's not okay.
Well, that's exactly right, is that it's means and ends. I mean,
yes.
So what always happens is people who are in trouble on the ends front say, oh, but previous presidents have said things that are untrue. Okay, but previous presidents have said things that are untrue in the furtherance of something that is at least attached in some way to an American value, or that is in the furtherance of something that is can be nominally put in the category of the job that a president should do. In this case, it's using that technique. And by the way, as we all know, the quid pro quo is only one part of this and isn't necessary for to make the case that the president has bent the foreign policy process in his White House in a way that's objectionable. But you're exactly right. If you're going to use the tools of statecraft, you have to use them for the state and not for yourself.
Hey, GabFest listeners, remember, we are going to be live at the Fox Theater in Oakland, California on Wednesday, December 18th for our annual Conundrum show. For tickets information, go to slate.com/live. There's still tickets available. We really want to see you there. That is going to be a delightful, delightful live show. And we also want to collect your conundrums. So tweet to us at SlateGabFest with the hashtag conundrum. Or go to slate.com/conundrum and submit your conundrum there. But really, it's a glorious night. You will learn a lot about the failings and in our character, probably mostly. But you'll also it will be a laugh riot. Go to slate.com/live, Wednesday, December 18th, Fox Theater in Oakland. This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
In a series of tweets on Wednesday, Jack Dorsey, the leader of Twitter, announced that Twitter would stop allowing political advertising or issue advertising about politically contentious issues. This, of course, is in stark contrast to our friends at Facebook, whose CEO Mark Zuckerberg said last week that Facebook would even accept political ads that are lies, that would not fact check lying political ads, and would gladly accept all sorts of political ads from whoever wanted to do it, from any candidate that wanted to do it. And YouTube, too, which also accepts a lot of political advertising. So, Emily, is it a big deal that Twitter is turning down these ads? It is an infinitesimally small amount of money that is at stake for Twitter. It is not a big platform for political advertising.
It's more about the debate among the social media platforms and among all of us about what we think the standard should be than it is about the practical import of Twitter running political ads. I mean, Facebook just has such a giant footprint in this world because of Facebook itself and then also because it owns Instagram and WhatsApp. You know, Jack Dorsey, as like a million people pointed out immediately, was basically subtweeting Mark Zuckerberg and getting a lot of praise quickly online from people who are concerned about false political advertising. I think a lot of us tend to see this through the lens of Donald Trump because the Trump campaign is running already a false ad about Joe Biden. And so it just seems like that is a threat. There's a counter argument about the way in which political ads, especially issue ads, can be very helpful for groups on the left and the right that are getting started, a way of galvanizing people, of making campaigns come together. You know, other candidates in the Democratic field like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders have seen their support really grow in part because of support and, you know, kind of avalanche of attention on platforms like Twitter. So it's not that this is like absolutely a slam dunk thing that's the right thing to do, but this problem of false information about elections and the way in which disinformation is destabilizing people's faith in the media, all kinds of media, traditional and social media, that debate is really important for us to be having. So I'm glad for that reason that Twitter is taking a different position and just making us all think about this.
One of the things that I find bizarre about this, John, is that if the premise of it is essentially that political ads are lies. Because if all political ads were, in fact, truthful ads, everyone...
No, I don't think that's
I think
right.
It is. I do think that's the premise of it.
I think the premise is that some of them are lies, and Twitter was saying we can't police. We don't want to get in there and decide which is which.
Right, but so it's essentially saying we'd rather
right.
than
like
having
that's the other option.
Rather than having speech, including what we all recognize are legitimate discussions of political issues and framings of political issues, so that candidates can make their point about who they are. It is safer, it better. For the public health, for hygiene, for political hygiene, for there to be not this discussion at all, for the discussion to have to take place in other ways, which I as a matter of public health, as a matter of epidemiology, I think is probably correct. But it's a little bit disconcerting for us to kind of collectively agree that the health of the country is better off if speech is limited in this way.
Well, remember, we're talking about the reach of paid speech, right. Not speech at all, right? I feel like that's an important distinction
totally.
To keep in mind.
Yes.
John, I'm sorry I interrupted you.
Well, that was actually just the point I was going to make, is the argument is that, reach should be earned and not paid for. I wonder if there's a hazard in that, which is to suggest then that anything that has reach has some kind of value, because it absolutely doesn't have that. And if we go all the way back to the beginning of our constitutional experiment, the idea of something that gains reach through popular passions is actually to be feared. So that part of it's a little tricky.
Yeah, to jump in there. I think that would be an easier point to make if Twitter itself wasn't such a atrocious ecosystem where people are able to gain reach through all kinds of dark methods, you know, using robots, using fake personalities, using, you know, some kind of baleful, completely mysterious foreign influence, at least with money. It's pretty transparent. I mean, I think another solution to this might be Twitter will allow political ads, but the tweets have to be super labeled. It's like, here's how much it cost, or here's who this is targeted at. So it's very evident what's going on. But instead, what's happening is you have this ecosystem where there's all sorts of disgusting, hostile stuff, where, you know, white nationalists are allowed to flourish, where anti-Semitism is allowed to flourish, where all kinds of mysterious, trollish foreign interference is allowed to flourish. And that's okay, because that's somehow like legitimate grassroots speech happening, but this purchase speech is not allowed to happen. Again, I don't know that I'm not saying that the solution is the wrong solution. It's just it doesn't really solve the problem that we have, which is that Twitter and Facebook are poisonous garbage piles for destroying political debate and discussion.
I like Emily's framing that this is best to be thought of as a chess move and an ongoing act of competition between social media companies, and that Jack Dorsey said in his long Twitter thread that it was hypocritical to say we're working hard to stop people from gaming our systems to spread misleading information. But if someone pays us to target and force people to see it, well, then they can say whatever they want. I think that's a nice thing to call out. But I think to your point, David, that the problem is that anybody will think that this actually gets at the root of the problem. It is a kind of perhaps good thing, although we've talked about how it may, in fact, have backfire effects. But whether it's good or backfires, it's really not. It doesn't feel like it gets at the core thing. One thing I wonder for either one of the two of you is, if you are a low information voter who is going to be influenced by a political ad.
I am a low information voter.
If you're going to be influenced by a political ad, and there's some problem with this question, but anyway, stick with me. If you're going to be influenced by a political ad and therefore it should be taken away from a thing that conveys value because of its reach, aren't you going to be swayed by some other thing pretty quickly and easily? And therefore, the actual effect of doing this is really not going to change the actual environment.
Yeah, I think that it will have a small effect overall. That doesn't mean it's okay to take money as a company for lying political advertisements, but it's not an overall solution. I mean, I think what you're putting your finger on is this fundamental challenge of creating a method of incredibly effective communication in terms of transmitting, you know, messages and ideas over these huge networks, but then having a problem of just being completely overrun in low quality or false information. Like, what happens when the way in which speech is suppressed is that there's so much terrible speech that you don't know what to trust anymore, and the true speech, true in any kind, just gets like completely overcome by that dynamic. We haven't faced up to that, and we're just starting to have a conversation about it, because it's antithetical to how we think about our First Amendment. We imagine still this marketplace of ideas in which the good ideas triumph in the end, not one in which the sludge buries anything decent beneath it.
By the way, if people are concerned about Donald Trump and his ability to kind of hoodwink people into voting for him again, which I think is implicit in some of the applauding for Twitter and some of the efforts to kind of try to sanitize what's a bilge-filled venue. If you look at the 30-second ad that the Trump campaign bought during the World Series on Wednesday night, you will see a far more powerful and effective ad.
It was a good ad.
It was a really good ad, and it's going for the voters they need.
I didn't see it. What was it?
Basically, the president touting with, you know, the traditionally massaged figures, but the economy,
immigration. He created 6 million new jobs, right, exactly. 500,000 manufacturing jobs. He smashed ISIS.
Exactly. I mean, it's your typical political ad, which isn't to say that it's true, but it and then it has a line in which it says he's no Mr. Nice Guy, but sometimes it takes a Donald Trump to change Washington. It also obviously has the al-Baghdadi news in it, which is of the moment. And this is aimed right at those, you know, suburban voters. And basically saying, trying to put in a category all of his downsides into the basket of, oh, well, he's no Mr. Nice Guy, but he gets the job done. That will be the bigger, more effective thing than the kinds of ads that are being taken off Twitter, I would guess. I can feel myself getting out on the end of a limb there, but
who knows?
But I think
the kind of the most powerful.
But that's legit, right? Like, that's his pitch for his, right. That's Trump's pitch, right. And like people should hear it and decide what they think about
it. But I think the thing about these Facebook and social media ads, and we've heard this about Facebook, and I'm not enough of a Facebook customer to know this, is that what you have is these tiny micro ecosystems, each of which is getting its own targeted Facebook ad,
right,
aimed at the susceptibilities of the people who happen to be interested in those subjects. And some of those may be
suppressing the vote.
And right. Some of those may be incredibly effective, but it's almost that there are too many of them for us to know whether they're what's happening, what's going on. Do you think, Emily, just switching...
Well, and also, sorry, can I say one more thing about this? And also, to piggyback onto that, there's the problem of how watching the political ads, the paid-for reach, could affect your personal algorithm. So then other garbage comes in that's not paid for because of your interest in the political ads or just the fact that you clicked on them.
Emily, actually, while we're here around Facebook, let's just talk about their contrasting approach. And there was a very interesting story this week. Facebook had said, Mark Zuckerberg had said in response to questioning from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, effectively, yes, a political candidate can lie in an ad. We're not going to stop them. They have essentially unlimited speech rights to say whatever they want in an ad that they're paying for on our platform. And so we now have this episode where a man in California named Adriel Hampton set out to create a bunch of dishonest ads attacking certain Republican candidates. Facebook dinged him, saying he wasn't a candidate himself, so he couldn't. Those ads were not allowed to get through. Then he made himself a candidate. He put himself on the ballot to run for governor in California to create dishonest ads. And Facebook is stopping him from creating lying ads, essentially saying, well, he announced that he's going to lie, so we can stop those ads. So you're only allowed to create lying ads if you don't say that you're lying about them. Do you think that the Facebook position, which is that all candidate ads can say whatever the hell they want, regardless of truth value, is going to hold?
No, for precisely the reasons you were just laying out. I mean, look, the fundamental problem here is that we are relying on a company to regulate our speech. And, like, this is not going to work. Like, where is the FCC in all of this setting rules? We have some constitutional law. It's sort of dimming, but it still remains that commercial speech, in other words, paid-for speech, has less value than other kinds of speech. There is a way in which the government could be setting some limits on whether political advertising can be utterly false. But leaving it up to a corporation means that you're having these judgment calls that immediately kind of eat away at the edges of the rule that you just set. And then the rule becomes sort of permeable and isn't, right? Like, part of Zuckerberg's justification is we don't want to be in the business of telling you what you can see and who can influence you. But, like, yes, they are setting limits.
Can I just go back to one thing which we've talked about before, but which, Emily, when you were talking about the laboratory conditions in which we would best hope to allow voters a chance to apply their reason towards the facts of the case and therefore pick the best candidate. I'm influenced by The Enigma of Reason, the recent book that basically argues that we misunderstand reason. That basically what reason is for is to justify ourselves and then explain our justifications to other people. That basically we're all just huge post hoc rationalizers, and that we do what we do and we are attracted to what we're attracted to, and then we use our reason to claim to construct something that makes us basically be able to look at ourselves in the mirror or go to sleep at night. And if that's the way we use reason, then we're trying to create a laboratory here in which none of us really want to go in. Not because what's in the laboratory isn't pristine and perfect, but it's because we're just not interested in that game. That game being the application of reason towards facts to make a decision that's the best for mankind. So if that's true, then then that again sort of blinds us from understanding how these social media networks work and how traditional advertising works and how political speech works.
But if that's true, then don't you want checks and balances to be reined in, right? I mean, that's an argument basically like the human id is destructive and we have lots of rules in society that try to prevent the human id in its completely fully realized form from running everything.
Yes, yes.
And so this is just one more.
Yeah. I didn't mean to suggest throw our hands up. What can you do? Your narrative is your narrative. My narrative is my narrative. I guess what I meant was, is there a smarter way? If you recognize the fact that reason is about post hoc rationalizations, then how do you attack that problem? Where do you attack that problem? And it's just, I guess, that question, and therefore then how does this move get at that problem, which it seems to me is the much bigger problem in a society that tries to take collective action to meet the challenges of the day?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, and it reminds we should say it's always important to say that whatever's happening on social media relates to and is less important than what's happening on television still.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's how so many voters take in their information. It's just a mistake to leave that out of the conversation, and television has its own ways of manipulating emotions, et cetera. And then we get into this question of, like, how do you inoculate people against false messages? There's some research that suggests that if you tell them beforehand, like, hey, someone's going to tell you climate change is a hoax, and they're telling you that because they have their own agenda, that can be helpful.
Final point is the problem, you're exactly right about television and the reach, and one of the other problems of classification here is we tend to see the world through Twitter. But man, it's amazing how much social media affects the decision made in what goes on and how debates are framed in television.
Yeah, that's part of what I mean, is they're related to each other.
Slate Plus members, you get bonus segments on the Gabfest and other Slate podcasts. Today, you have a special Slate Plus segment coming because John and Emily were having an extremely boisterous, just extremely smart conversation before we started the show. And they just, it's because they are true public intellectuals, they're also private intellectuals, and they were engaged with each other around a really interesting topic involving separation of powers, I think. I was doing other things. I was just doing clerical work. And so we decided, because the tape was running, we're going to do that as our Slate Plus conversation. It's a super treat. So go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to get unadulterated Dickerson Bazelon.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
Katie Hill, freshman Democratic member of Congress from California, resigned from the House this week after a strange and sad scandal involving workplace sexual misbehavior on her campaign, possibly in her congressional office, and then a revenge porn incident may have been orchestrated by her estranged husband or by a former girlfriend of hers. Emily, do you want to walk us through the basics of this, where how we got where we are?
Oh, Katie Hill. Yeah, this is a kind of sad saga, right? So, seems like confirmed that Katie Hill and her husband were having a relationship with a 22-year-old campaign staffer, which is not technically against the congressional rules, but seems to fall into the realm of like very questionable judgment, especially because there are texts suggesting that the staffer felt abused by this threesome relationship and there were some, you know, unpleasant parts of it that made her feel exploited. Okay, so that happened. You can think about that. Then there is this problem that Hill's ex-husband or her husband, who she's planning to divorce, at least according to Hill, let out into the world a whole bunch of sexualized pictures of Hill, which are out there, you know, without her consent. And that's very troubling because they've been used to humiliate her. And that's, I mean, in my mind, like clearly really bad. And that would not be a reason to suggest that someone should resign from Congress. Then there's a third issue, which is that Hill's soon-to-be ex-husband has accused her of having an affair with a staffer on the Hill, separate person. And if that was true, that would violate congressional rules. You're not allowed to, as a member of Congress, have a sexual relationship with someone on your staff. But we don't know whether that's true, and Hill has denied it. So it's tricky because if the third box, if you could check it, like, yes, we knew that that affair had happened, that's clearly against the rules. There are all kinds of good reasons to have those rules. Doesn't matter in my mind one whit that Hill is a woman and the staffer is a man instead of the usual scenario of the other way around. If we knew that to be true, then it would be really clear that Hill should resign. But we don't. And so then that leads me back to the initial set of accusations about this relationship with this 22-year-old female campaign staffer. And really the question is whether that, in my mind, the question is that poor enough judgment on its own? Does it smack of, you know, Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky in a way that's just like not okay? And so that's grounds for Hill to resign without the other parts of the story.
And actually, can I add a fourth element, which just came to light in the last couple of days, which is that it also appears that this is fundamentally a OPPO research scandal in the sense that the person who wrote the story for Red State, the journalist who broke the story, was an advisor to a consultant for Hill's Republican opponents. Not to say that the facts in this are necessarily inaccurate. It does have an element of political hit job to it as well, and using repurposing media for political purposes.
One quick definitional thing, Emily. I was confused by – so in 2018, following the Me Too movement, the House of Representatives decides there are going to be new rules that prohibit sexual relationships between members and their aides. That's clean. Okay. So – but we're talking here about a campaign aide. But the Post reported that the Ethics Committee had concluded that that it did have jurisdiction over campaign stuff. Now,
successful campaign. A
successful campaign. Right. Okay. Right. Because for the same reason the Ethics Committee has no sway over somebody who resigns after they resign, it has no sway over defeated campaigns because they're not a member of Congress. But here's the question I don't understand about the Post is, does the fact that the Ethics Committee looks into campaign behavior of successful candidates, you could imagine a situation. So that's fine. Let's imagine it's theft or something. Does that carry over to the coercive nature of a relationship? In other words, is this claim that a coercive relationship with a working staffer in the Congress is the same as a coercive relationship in the campaign? I think we don't know the answer to that, but there seems some lack of clarity there setting aside the point you made, which is that if she was having this affair that's been alleged that she denies with somebody who's existing on her staff, that is clearly a problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think the answer to that is that the Congress hasn't decided yet. Like, this is a new rule, and so they probably don't have a lot of examples yet to make that decision about whether their jurisdiction and also their standards are just coextensive in the campaign scenario. I mean, I kind of think they should be, right?
I lost the predicate there.
They should be the same. Like, I don't really see why you would have, like, the reason that you don't want a member of Congress to have an affair with a staff member is the power imbalance there. And the same, if not more, applies in the setting of a campaign where you have often a lot of really young people. You have, like, a much more tumultuous, kind of tethered set of working relationships. Like, people are working all the time. They're in all kinds of informal situations with each other. It seems to me that if the Rules Committee is going to say we have jurisdiction over campaigns, then you just want to have the same clean rule in that setting as well. I'm a little nervous about this.
Right.
Wait a minute. What are you?
I think the behavior is just as bad and possibly worse, but she doesn't have the job yet. It's not – how should Congress have jurisdiction over something that happened before this person is actually a member of Congress?
Well, they've claimed jurisdiction over campaigns in other areas. So why would this be – keeping Emily's good frame in mind, this is a question of jurisdiction and question of standards. If they've already said the jurisdiction relates to campaigns, then why should the standard be different?
I mean, I think that an EEOC complaint or criminal – if someone steals from a campaign, there should be criminal prosecution of that. But I don't know that Congress – is Congress entitled to police its members for things that they do before they're members of the House? I guess maybe they are.
Well,
for things they do out of the House? I guess maybe.
I mean, it's basically sexual harassment, right? And I guess I'm – what's the – what – so here's the upside of – extending jurisdiction and having the same standard is that you're creating an incentive for someone running for Congress to behave with care. Like, what do we lose from that? Katie Hill, she's not going to jail. She is going to be fine, but she's about to lose her job. Like, that is not a happy event, but she was given this position of high honor and trust by the voters. So should someone aspiring to that job start inculcating a personal high standard of conduct before they get
there? But I guess she's being punished by the public. She resigned before there was any official investigation. And so what? Why would I certainly agree that if she did these acts, there is some punishment due to her and some public suffering due to her as a member of Congress, and she abused a public trust in running for campaign. I guess what all I'm talking about is that is the right punishment mechanism, the House Ethics Committee sanctioning her or expelling her from Congress for something that she did before. It seems to me like, no, there's good public punishment that's happening. She's been disgraced and she has chosen to resign rather than face something more official.
Well, presumably.
Really, I would rather have her go through this due process than have Nancy Pelosi just pull the plug on her, which seems to be what happened. Sorry, John.
Well, also, the House could take the public shame into account when it made its ultimate recommendation about whatever it evaluated her behavior to have been. And they could say she's suffered enough and she can stay on and that's fine. I mean, but that's a determination for them to make, because imagine there was no public opprobrium. So would that then mean the House does nothing? I think the standard question goes this way, I think, and it's a version of what people hauled out when they were talking about the Russia matter with President Trump was, I think it was Hamilton who said, basically, how you come to office, if you do that in a corrupt way, it infects the office that you hold.
And that's therefore, pretty good standard.
So if that's the standard, then the House can say, well, what you have done after we've sifted through all the facts does or doesn't infect the office, or you've infected a little bit and so you've been censured and now you can continue being in the office, but we've cleansed it and we've made this determination on behalf of the body relative to the way you got into the office. I guess that's the way you would kind of work through how to apply a standard to something you were doing before you had the job.
That makes sense. I mean, the other thing is that the resigning before there's any procedure, right?
I just said fruit of the poison tree.
Fruit of the poison tree.
Just to make John happy.
That's from the Fourth Amendment. You're dragging it into a different context entirely. I guess the reason I wish that instead of just these abrupt resignations. And I'm thinking now of Al Franken's situation. I would like to have some procedure for the sake of the due process rights of the member. Sure. Yes. But also because, especially in this, well, actually in both situations, I would like it to be clear what the actual problem is, right? You have a swirl of accusations and problems. I do not want Katie Hill to be punished or to have to resign because of these photos. And so if she's done something wrong, let's like isolate it, make it clear what it is, and not have someone feel like she's being punished for something that is like a terrible blow to inflict on her and deeply unfair.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting. We're human beings. Right. Not that it shouldn't be interesting. It shouldn't be what is magnetic to you or what. And you should I mean, I have not looked at these photos. I haven't read the texts. I haven't done any of the kind of due diligence about this because I feel like it's whatever. I wouldn't if I were in the on the other end of this, I wouldn't want people to do it to me. And I think it just is not
Well, I read the text because I wanted to understand whether the relationship with the 22-year-old staffer seemed abusive or not. And it seemed like the only way to figure that out was to, like, read the evidence. I didn't think that looking at the photos was necessary for that. And I don't want to look at anything that smacks of revenge porn. So I didn't do that. But the text seemed like part of the case.
Although, although the reason you have a case and the reason you adjudicate this in a place where you can kind of keep some of this at bay is that what people write – the dishing people do through texts to each other and the claims they make about who's abusing who and for what can be, highly misleading.
Yeah.
Right. Because it's in their interest to define the other person in as horrible a terms as possible. Yeah. And so you would hope to kind of contextualize that in a formal proceeding.
100%. Good point. That's a really good point. Actually, I actually think John makes a very good point there. People use text is much more like the kind of casual speech than it is like a formal document. And it would be terrible to be held to account for all the things, all like the kind of half thrown out, half tossed out remarks that one has made in life. And
I agree. Right. I mean, yeah.
And so to excavate, to do a huge dig through no doubt thousands and thousands and thousands of texts that someone has done and pick out and cherry pick the times when they've said things which were unfortunate or abusive or like, reveal something it's kind of gross. And maybe we should declare those to be almost off limits in the way that I think you would declare or you would hope that these photos are off limits or there's other forms of what are basically private casual communication should be. You should look at them only in the most rarefied circumstances with a lot of guardrails around it.
To me, what you're talking about or what makes sense to me is that trial by media is a big problem. This is another thing with having no process. Like if Congress was looking through the text and then deciding in context, viewed as a whole, whether there were abusive elements that were dispositive, that would be a lot better than like whatever happens to rain down on us from what Katie Hill's allegedly abusive soon-to-be ex-husband is leaking.
Let's go to cocktail chatter. When you're, I don't know what you're doing. When you're not looking at revenge porn, not reading other people's texts, just having a contemplative cocktail, John Dickerson, this weekend. What are you going to be chattering about?
Well, we often lament the things that aren't being covered as much while the madness of our age is has us all in its grip. This week, the National Assessment of Education Progress, the nation's report card, the NAEP scores came out, and they and Emily will put this in context if I've freaked out about this too much. But 2 out of 3 children in America are not, and these are fourth graders and eighth graders, are not proficient in reading. The numbers, which is awful. The numbers for certain cities since 1990 have actually improved a little, but at about 2009, they plateau in the cities. Washington, D.C., actually, the 27 cities to participate is actually saw improvement in eighth grade reading. But basically, the situation is getting worse since 2009, and there are a number of troubling lines in this Times piece where I learned all of this, but perhaps the most troubling line was there is no consensus among experts as to why. And so we see obviously two different kinds of responses from the Department of Education, which is to push charter schools, and then you've got the sum of the discussion on the presidential campaign trail with Democrats. But it seems like that is a huge alarm bell.
Emily, what is your chatter?
I'm having a kind of Handmaid's Tale gloom and doom moment here, reading about how Missouri is tracking the menstrual periods of women who visited an abortion clinic in Missouri. The state claims to be doing this to figure out how many abortions, quote, failed as a way of regulating this clinic. This is all supposed to be in the name of protecting women's health and making sure that abortion clinics are safe places. But in reality, abortion is a much, much safer procedure than many other procedures that the state is not anything like this invasive about. And I mean, I just – the idea of being a patient at a clinic and giving up this private medical information and then having it turn into some spreadsheet that state officials are picking their way through is just like utterly horrifying to me. And I just do not understand how this is where we've arrived.
It's grotesque. I have two quick chatters. I was just going to do one. Then I remembered a second one. First is we didn't talk about the death of ISIS leader – Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, but there was a very interesting detail. Everyone's talking about these dogs, and there was a really interesting detail that I didn't know about dogs, which is that the dogs outrank their handlers.
Huh.
According to army regulations, the dogs are given, I mean, dogs don't have a rank, but in army parlance and army tradition and army custom, the dogs are one rank higher than whoever handles them, and the idea is to prevent mistreatment. The idea is that the dog is the sort of the superior officer, and so that whoever's training them will treat them well. I doubt they mistreat their dogs anyway, but it's a kind of interesting, odd tradition. So my other chatter is I saw a very interesting exhibit at the Kennedy Center this weekend. The Kennedy Center has a new, in Washington, D.C., has a new arm. It's built an extension called The Reach, and it has exhibition space and performance space and classroom space, and they're inaugural exhibition is portraits by President George W. Bush of wounded warriors. It's called Portraits of Courage, a Commander-in-Chief's Tribute to America's Warriors. It's about 100 portraits that Bush has made over the years of mostly men and a few women who were wounded in action, mostly in wars that the president himself started in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's playing, it's up at The Reach until November 15th. And it's pretty good. It's actually pretty good. His portraits are, they look like real people. They feel like real faces. You feel like you're seeing something in them. They're not the greatest portraits you've ever seen, but he has a real style and there's a real emotion to them. And it's good. You will get more out of it than you might get out of some other random exhibit. And there's also a kind of charming interview with Bush at the start of it where he's quite funny. So if you are in Washington in the next couple of weeks, I kind of recommend this. Yeah.
That
All right.
was so...
Well, it was surprising. I kind of went on a lark. I wanted to see The Reach and it was what was playing, but it's for real. It's for real. And it's a genuinely interesting project that he's undertaken. He's done it well. He's acquitted himself well. And it says something about these people and about America and about him. And yeah, there's nothing but admiration for me there. Listeners, you continue to send us great chatters. You tweet to us at Slate Gabfest, that which you are discussing at your cocktail parties. And this week, we have from Chris Anderson at Chris N. Hamp, a very funny listener chatter, which is a kind of a version of, I think we actually did an earlier version of something similar to this, but it's about some eagles that were being tracked by Russia, migrating eagles. And these migrating eagles were flying all around Russia and the steppes, and then they went south into Iran, and they had these tracking devices on them. And what happened is when they went into Iran, these tracking devices suddenly racked up enormous roaming bills. So these researchers, suddenly they didn't expect their eagles to go that far, and so they didn't pay whatever you need to pay to get on the Iranian the Iranian cell network. And so they end up with these gigantic bills from these eagles that were constantly sending signals back about where they were in Iran. And it was about how they had to scramble to pay off the bill and how they had to ask the mobile carrier to cut them a break. It's a very charming little story. So check it out on Engadget about migrating eagles. That is our show for today. The Gabfest is produced by Jocelyn Frank. Melissa Kaplan engineered here in D.C., and she's in an absolutely spectacular Halloween outfit. She's Gentleman Jack, and it's just such a treat to see her. Our researcher is Bridget Dunlap. I have no idea if Bridget is in costume. She's in costume as a brilliant researcher, but that's not a costume. That's her real life outfit. Gabriel Roth is editorial director. June Thomas is managing producer of Slate Podcasts. Ryan McAvoy engineered Emily in New Haven. I don't know if Ryan's in costume. You should follow us on Twitter at @SlateGabFest. Tweet chatter to us. Tweet conundrums to us with hashtag conundrum. And come to our conundrum show on December 18th in Oakland at the Fox Theater. Go to slate.com/live for tickets. For Emily Bazelon and for John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. Thank you for listening. We'll talk to you next week. Hello, Slate Plus. Unusual Slate Plus segment today. We had a whole segment planned, but then as we were getting ready to start the show, John and Emily fell into conversation while I was doing some other random thing, and their conversation was incredibly interesting. So at the end of it, we just said, why don't we make this our Slate Plus segment? So here you have unadulterated Dickerson Bazelon brain power.
I have this piece that's closing tomorrow that has these various separation of powers framers thing in it. And the one thing I will say to you, which is so obvious, but I'd never thought about, is this great quote where the Supreme Court says, if the framers had wanted to prevent friction between the branches, they could have created three airtight departments, and they didn't. And I just had never really thought about that, that like, I mean, it's super obvious, but they overlap in all these ways, right?
Yeah. So,
and there's like quotes from Madison about how we are saying that they're in each other's way. That's not his
right.
words, but I can find the quote for you. I mean, you probably have it.
You mean separate and apart from ambition versus ambition, or?
Yeah, there's one where he just says it's the separation of powers does not mean, quote, that these departments, meaning the branches, ought to have no partial agency in or no control over the acts of each other. It's from the Federalist Papers.
Yeah. And was that because by design or just post hoc rationalization for a bad?
I mean, you have to go look, but it is by design, like in the sense that when you think about, I mean, there are all these examples once you start thinking about it, right? It's, impeachment is an example. Selecting, you know, advice and consent is an example, right? There are all these ways. Yeah.
Well, because they wanted everybody to constrain everybody else by giving them a little bit of a foothold in the other's power. They thought that would be a check on the power.
Precisely.
Which, yeah,
it's part of checks and balances. Yeah, exactly. Right. I just hadn't really thought of it in those terms somehow, I guess. And then this is another thing that I didn't end up writing about, but the whole battle we've had since Watergate over how to investigate the president is about this. Can you have the Independent Counsel Act puts part of the responsibility for choosing a special prosecutor with the judiciary. Then we decide both parties decide like the special counsels are going too far. We don't want that anymore. And now it's back in the executive branch fully. And then that has problems too.
Right. So the whole reason I'm going back to the founders is basically saying, you know, they thought long and hard about how much would be done by the system and how much would be governed by the virtue of the person in the office.
Yes, you know,
the difference
that's
between
totally.
The people who make the moralist case and those who make the institutionalist case. And both are – you have to have a mix of both. And the problem is we've had maximalist presidents like our current one who – I went and talked to a bunch of senators about this yesterday. And they're like, we never thought they would – I mean, the founders never thought that a president would jam his foot on the accelerator like this. The whole point of hiring somebody with a sufficient amount of virtue is that they would know when to pull back. There's this great section in the debate at the Constitutional Convention where they basically say, you know, the president doesn't need a veto power because – if he realizes Congress really, really, really wants something, he'll stand back and recognize that, like, if they want it that much, they must be right.
Right, which George Washington might have done. Right. But I guess thing I wonder about, and you must be grappling with this, is that because the framers also weren't thinking about parties, and so they totally missed that dynamic, how can you even – all of these things – just are different because of that. Everything is different because of that.
Exactly. So they were like talking about the quaint rules of monogamy, and turns out it was Babylon within basically one administration.
Precisely.
Yeah. No, it's crazy. They, when you think about originalism and whatever that actually means, they not only obviously were they not only were awful with respect to the rights of humans with respect to slavery, right? But they completely missed, and they were obsessed with ambition and power and designing knaves. Obsessed, right? They were freaking out about it, and yet they missed that parties would be upon them within like 5 minutes.
Yes.
Right? That's crazy when you when you look at how completely obsessed they were about the absolute original sin of man and how that had to be guarded against in government or else.
Yes.
It's crazy that they missed that. I kind of run by that quickly, but it's absolutely true. Yeah, now I want to send you all the founders
chapters.
Well,
send me whatever you would like.
GabFest fans, that was just a teaser. To hear the rest of our Slate Plus conversation, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a Slate Plus member today.